Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm Jeff Howard, and I'm very excited because the filmmaker I'm talking to today is Jeremy Shing. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. We are on Zoom, if people can't tell. So I'll give my quickest Zoom disclaimer, which is Jeremy and I are not going to talk over each other, but there's like a micro delay in the recording of Zoom. So if it sounds like we do, or if you don't like the audio quality, don't blame us. Blame the massive Zoom corporation that COVID made a $1 billion company. But it's also very convenient. We get to talk, even though we're in the same city, we get to talk without, I still got pajamas on, so.
Yeah, that's one of the beauties of Zoom. I also want to say, Jeff, I think you have a really great voice for podcast hosts.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I've joked with filmmakers before that I'm just waiting for somebody to ask me to do voiceover. And I'm sitting around going, hey, but thank you. Thank you so much for the compliment. Well, Jeremy, I'm going to mention your film now. I know you for the short film Fish that you wrote, you co-wrote and you directed it and you co-produced it. And Fish is a wonderful film. Like, it was one of, you know, people who listen to this podcast. Hopefully there's enough regular listeners catching this one that know that I really love when films get a little more creative than average. I mean, I love a nice standard straight. If you got a standard straight drama story to tell and it's told wonderfully, I love that film. But Fish falls into the, drama art house sort of world, and that's my world. I just absolutely love a film that is just off the beaten path and a little more original and creative than the crap that Hollywood puts out, where if someone gets a little too creative, they get stopped right away. So congratulations on making this wonderful short film Fish. Congratulations. It actually won an audience award at Film Invasion Los Angeles last year in 2023. So I'm on Zoom. I'm giving Jeremy a little golf clap with my hands holding him up. So it's great work.
Yeah. Appreciate the golf clap. I definitely believe that like genre is a way to cut through the noise. While I can't appreciate a straight up drama, for me as a storyteller, I like using genre as a way in to try to make it unique from other stories that are out there.
Excellent. Yeah. And as you know, I'm about to ask for your life story as a creative person, but I guess I'll also mention that if people want to see Fish, I'm kind of happy to say they'll probably be able to catch it on TV High if they want to watch it there. And I can promise you, you've never seen a film like Fish before, and it's smart, and it's funny, and it's touching, and it's heartwarming. A joke at the film festivals on the juries is like, if you touch me, my eyes water a little bit, and I don't cry at sadness. I cry it when I'm touched, like when it's actually happiness makes me sometimes well up a little more than sadness. But I find your film like very touching.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. Also, really interesting what you said about the happiness makes you cry more than sadness. I feel like I want to use that in a script somehow now.
I almost am stealing it from that Flaming Lips song. You realize it was like, and the guy sings happiness makes you cry. It's true. But anyway. So people can go to TV High. It's a smart TV app that, yes, I am responsible for, which is why I'm mentioning it. But yeah, it's on Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, Android TV, iPhone, and Android Mobile. So, you know, check it out. Free trial. Make sure you watch Fish first. But one thing I love about TV High is there's an art house section where, oh, man, those films are so creative and so original. Like, never seen anything like them, and no two are the same. So, you know, I can't say that about the other streaming services.
Yes, we love the shade.
Yes, I know. I definitely throw I mean, that's the joy of having a podcast, right? Of just, and speaking at a, you know, I love to shit on Hollywood a little bit. Because, you know, they do wonderful stuff for a lot of people, maybe. I don't know. Obviously. A lot of people wanted to see Top Gun 2, but that's not me. I want something else. I want to see something I haven't seen before. So with that in mind, I'm gonna shut up and just... You already mentioned, I think you already mentioned story and storytelling. So when did you get involved in storytelling in the creative arts?
Yeah, I guess the TLDR would be from the womb, but I'll give context to that. So I was born February 29, 2000, which is leap day. And I was basically, my mom didn't want me to be born on leap day because she thought the day was cursed, but my big head had other plans. I was born like pretty late into the night of that day. And my dad, I think he's the embodiment of like cultural toxic masculinity.
Right. So just from a culture where, yeah, men are men.
Exactly. But I think deep down inside, he's kind of like a teddy bear. You know, you have to like try to find it. He was so nervous that day when I was born, as most parents are, you know, like you're having this living being and now you have to take care of them for the rest of your life. So he was super nervous. And then me being a baby, being exposed to the world, I'm like crying and stuff. But the one thing that we bonded over was that night, it was like the Lakers versus the Trailblazers. And my mom said both of us watched the screen and both of us calmed down. So, yeah, growing up, sports was how I connected with my dad, basketball in particular.
Were you an Angelino? Was it your dad's a Laker fan?
Yeah, he's like a diehard Laker fan ever since he was a kid. So that was like the language we would use to interact with each other, saying like, how was your day is awkward, but did you catch that game felt natural. So although I'm lucky enough to be relatively tall, I'm like 6'1", but I was not blessed with stamina. I feel like very low stamina. So basketball... as an athlete never was an option for me. Although I do say like pick up games with friends, I'm pretty good. But I thought if I couldn't play basketball, I could write about basketball. That would be my entry point in. So that's what I did. In high school, I joined the high school newspaper and then worked my way up to editor-in-chief. And my goal was to be a sports reporter, work for ESPN. That's how I could make my dad proud, basically. And then my senior year, that was like around, I mean, this is going to get political, but this is like around when...
I encourage that.
Okay. This is around when like, you know, Donald Trump became president and there was this attack on like, free press. And then there's also this advent of social media where everyone was becoming their own like news reporter and everyone was living in these echo chambers. So I felt really jaded about becoming like, I don't know, a talking head or pursuing a path where I'm just reporting on other people's stories. And I felt an inclination to like tell my own stories. So I literally just Googled like how to write a screenplay and then went from there. And then I was like, I think this would make me more creatively fulfilled in this one life that I have. So then I told my parents about that and they were like, no. But like,
and by the way, this is still in high school. This is like at the,
yeah,
senior, when, like, year. Senior year when you were editor in chief of the paper and you were
exactly
like...
So my entire life up to there, they were like, Jeremy's that writing guy who likes sports. And for some reason they thought sports reporter is more stable than like film. I guess it is in some ways. Some ways it isn't. It's debatable. Yeah.
It's just perception, right? Yeah.
Exactly. But yeah, so when I was submitting for college, we came up with a compromise where I could like submit to film schools for screenwriting. And then I can go there if I get in, unless I get into UCLA. So UCLA, I applied for psychology, actually, because in high school, my favorite class I ever took was psychology. I was lucky enough to have that experience of that one teacher that is very formative in your life, who like really champions who you are. And she told me about the intersection between like psychology and screenwriting, how so much of screenwriting is just the study of human behavior and a lot of the flaws that we see in compelling characters come from trauma, and that's something you learn in psychology, stuff like that. So yeah, I basically applied because I'm based in SoCal. So I applied to all the UCs as a psychology major, and then I applied to local film schools as screenwriting with no portfolio or experience. I actually got into a couple of film schools for screenwriting, which I felt was very validating, given that I have like no background in screenwriting.
You did have the writing background with the reporting, which is, I could see them respecting that.
Yeah. But I also ended up getting into UCLA for psychology, which I know it's so privileged to say, but I was like pretty sad when I got into UCLA. Like the context of that, actually, full circle, was like I was playing basketball with my friends after school, and they were all opening up their letters on their phone on like if they got into certain colleges or not. But I knew that a moment like that, my parents would want to experience with me. So they were all opening it up on their phones at the basketball court, all getting rejected and stuff. So then I was like, okay, I'll just wait until I get home. I got home, and then my parents were actually about to head out the door for something. And then I was like, wait, Mom, I think you would want to know about this. And they're like, oh, that's whatever it is, not important. We have to like go to this event. And then I was like, oh, okay. It was just the letter if I got into UCLA or not. And like, oh, cancel the event. And then, yeah, we all gathered around the computer screen, and obviously I got in, and like my dad was like bawling, like you never see him cry like that. And he was calling everyone he knows, people he hasn't talked to in like decades, just to like brag that I got into UCLA. So obviously I like have to go to UCLA. There's no way I could let him down and go to film school like that. But ultimately I think that was the best decision I could have made for my writing, because psychology gave me such a unique point of view and entry point into storytelling.
Right. So you did go to UCLA as a psych major.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you did your 4 years and got your bachelor's.
Yeah. And I also picked
up. You have a BS in psychology.
Yeah. And I also picked up a film and art history double minor. So it helped like round out that college experience and really open my worldview, because yeah, I'm sure you've heard the advice of like, if you just live in the world of film, then you have no point of view. So it's important to like experience things and learn about things outside of the field so that you have something to say. But yeah, I think psychology helped me find my lens into storytelling, in that I'm really interested in like exploring mental health and destigmatizing it and like deconstructing toxic masculinity and stuff like that. This is like potentially naive for me to say, but I view it like a therapist can only help dozens of people maximum. But if I use those concepts in my storytelling, I could help a lot more people. So that's kind of, yeah, my story.
I completely agree with the professor who's or teacher who said to you that psychology is critical to writing, because yeah, I think it's hugely critical. And right, as a viewer of a film or reading a book, if the psychology of the characters is off or untrue, right? If it's that never passes the sniff test, right? It's just nothing's a bigger turnoff than watching a film and there being like zero insight into the human condition, you know? I mean,
yeah. Totally agree.
Totally with you. So you graduate. Congrats. And for anyone listening to this who doesn't like really know about college rankings and shit, I mean, I happen to have a stepdaughter who's applying to college and very soon, but UCLA is really hard to get into. In fact, it's surpassed Berkeley, I believe. Back in my day, it was Berkeley number one, UCLA number two. And now like UCLA is harder to get into than Berkeley. It's amazing.
Yeah, so, I'm definitely familiar with that. My parents always like tell their friends like how UCLA is the hardest of the UCs.
It is. And I have friends who, I shouldn't say this. It's funny though. I have friends who like, you know, have a lot of money and send their kids to fancy private schools. And they say things to me like, oh, no one get into UCLA anymore. No one from the fancy private school gets into UCLA, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, maybe your kids just aren't exceptional. Like maybe the problem isn't UCLA. Maybe it's that, you know,
yeah,
I know lots of people actually whose kids have gotten into UCLA.
Mm.
So, you know, maybe paying for a fancy private school is not as good as just, you know, making sure your kid is supported and reads a lot. I don't know. So anyway, after graduating, did you have any thought of going into psychology or you were thinking film the whole time?
Yeah. Well, my parents were like, you should be a therapist. But I was like, I want to try this writing thing. So I think they were on the fence, but I was able to do so many internships and have professional experiences where they recognize the name, where they're like, okay, we will put all of our pre-med dreams into Jeremy's little brother and Jeremy will be that film person that got away. So yeah, that's kind of what happened.
You hadn't mentioned the younger brother before. Yeah, that helps when there's a backup kid.
Yeah, for sure.
But bravo to you, by the way, because I think in psychology you learn about birth order things. Yeah. And right often it's the older sibling does all the responsible stuff and then the younger one gets to be the artist.
Yeah, I think our family dynamic is interesting in that way because I'm often referred to as the younger brother. My younger brother is like way more mature than me. I don't know if I'm presenting as immature in this Zoom, but the way I interact with my family, I'm definitely like, maybe not a troublemaker, but I like to have fun with them and make jokes and stuff.
Excellent. Yeah, no, you're coming across as quite mature, but I get it. In the family context, you get we all choose a role, right?
Yeah. They unlock, like, I feel like the way you interact with your family is so singular compared to how you interact with the public. Like, you could be the most mature person in the world, but your parents just bring out a different side of you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And when you're a parent, when you pick your kid up from someone's home and you're ready to apologize for the way the kid acted, even though you have not heard a report, and they're like, oh, they were great. They were a pleasure. They said, please and thank you. I'm like, that kid hasn't said please or thank you once in our house.
That's so
for 11 years and you're telling me she was polite to you?
Yeah.
Anyway, but that's how we are. Yeah. We're very different within the family structure because we have complete, well, we not always, but often there's right a level of security and you don't have to worry about them saying you can't come back.
Yeah. I think it's maybe like it has to do with a level of trust and comfortability. Maybe that person you are with your family is your genuine self. And then outside of that, you're putting on a persona to function in society. I don't know.
Could be. All right. So let me get back to your creative side.
Yeah.
So while you, so you did do the minor. So you were doing, you were pursuing your creative side during your bachelor's with your minor.
Yeah, I was basically using what I was learning in my psychology classes and then picking up any writing or directing classes that I could take with my minor and trying to implement the psychology concepts into film. And
were you completing things? Were you interested in shooting yet or just at the writing stage?
Yeah, I think I was just finding out my voice. I did do the Film Summer Institute at UCLA, and my first script that I ever wrote was selected to be produced. It was kind of like a Black Mirror-esque short film through the lens of a tiger mom. In retrospect, it like sucked, but I learned so much through that experience. And I think it cemented my desire to use stories to tell things.
Interesting. Interesting. And well, you might say it sucked, but it was chosen to be produced. So it might have sucked the very least of all the things.
That's what I think happened. I think there were like 20 people who pitched and then like two projects were greenlit. So I was lucky that I was one of the two.
Very cool. Very cool. Did you get to stay with it through production or were you more like just they took it and produced it or?
Yeah, it was everyone in the Film Summer Institute wore different hats basically on set. So for that project, I was the script supervisor. And then the other project that got greenlit, I was actually the gaffer. And I have no idea how to do all that lighting stuff.
Right. So you were doing technical busy work jobs.
Yeah.
On your script. So you were not the director.
Mm-mm. So that taught me a lot too of like a story goes through three stages, you know, the writing, the actual filming, and then the edit. In that way, there's like three scripts basically, and a lot will change in that process.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So you got to be part of the process from start to finish. That's in a summer. That is a very cool way to experience it. And yeah. and that strikes because a lot of people do have the story. I hear the story of, you know, so I got tired of writing. So I directed one.
Mm.
But by being on the crew of a script that you wrote, you get to see things very differently.
Yeah. For sure. I think it's important to know what all the different roles are and the limits of production and post-production so that you could be mindful of it when you were writing the script. I guess a funny anecdote related to the Summer Institute, I actually had to like make a PowerPoint and pitch it to my parents to convince them to let me do it because it costs like a decent amount of money. But yeah.
Oh, so you had to so you had to pitch to get into the program.
Well, I had,
you had to pitch your parents to cover it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was like an application that they had to like read a couple essay questions to see if you were fitting. But I think my parents were more strict than the Institute was.
I get it. I mean I kind of do want to compare that. That's actually a good experience too, to instead of just getting a green light all the time, which Lord knows a lot of parents are like that.
Mm.
Maybe having to convince them is a good thing.
Yeah. I remember a slide, and my mom tells me about this slide a lot, of like, once I have a stable job, I'll pay everything back like twofold or something. So she reminds me of that every once in a while, that once, if I make it in the industry, to make sure to pay them back for everything they did for me.
Sure. Thankfully, there's no deadline on that debt, so you can wait a while.
Yeah.
She forgot to put in a due date.
That's true. Yeah.
Curious question. You mentioned the word tiger mom about that script, right?
Yeah.
Did they read the script too before agreeing to cover the summer program? Or they just trust you?
They didn't. Because I didn't even know if I was going to write for the program. I was just, because the Institute was actually like a film production summer institute.
Oh, right. So, and then you just pitched your idea and they.
Yeah,
they
I didn't even know there would be an option for me to write at all. But once that opportunity came up, then, you know, obviously seize the opportunities that are in front of you.
Gotcha. So obviously I was. My inference there was that your writing is about parents, yeah. And you're turning to your parents for help. I was wondering if they were aware how inspiring they are for the material.
Yeah, I would also say, like, I let them know that it is fiction, you know, like, actually. Maybe the vibe I've been giving off in this podcast is like that they are like very strict, and in some ways they are, but they also are like very progressive and open-minded. I think at the end of the day, they just, like most parents do, they just want their kids to be happy and to, I don't know, not have to worry about putting a roof over their heads. And that's really their ultimate goal. So I empathize a lot with the worry they have for me pursuing a career that is so unstable and in flux. So, yeah, I don't ever like hold a grudge against them for having those worries. I really understand.
No, and honestly, they're not coming across as stereotypically strict parents. They're coming across as certainly more open-minded. Because they have given you the thumbs up on a lot of this. I mean, not that it's required at your current age, but yeah, no, their level of support definitely is coming through. But interestingly, that and I mean, Fish is about a relationship with someone's mom too. But it's all fictional. Obviously, I guess you can tell me in psychology. I mean, the parent relationships is a huge part of. The relationship between child and parent is huge in psychology, I guess.
Yeah, I think so much of the addictions that people experience and deal with as adults is rooted in childhood trauma. And I mean, I guess this is me getting on my soapbox, but like, if, like, for example, if someone is addicted to alcohol, people will judge them for the alcohol. But if you think about why are they addicted to alcohol, it gives them, like, you know, a sense of peace or like a sense of calm. In a vacuum, those things of peace and calm are a good thing. And so you have to think about the pain that causes them to want to turn to alcohol. And then that is almost always rooted to something that happened in their childhood.
It is. I believe this, we're on the, we're dealing with the subject of like self-medication, right? Like,
yeah.
Like a lot of people with addiction issues are medicating something else. And
yeah.
Exactly. Are a lot of people in our society and in the world judge them as if they're choosing to do something terrible instead of that they're treating pain. And, you know, if they happen to have had the wherewithal to seek help elsewhere, they might have, But when you're in pain and dealing with life, my God, what, it's a lot easier to turn to a substance than to find a therapist who works for you, who you interact with well and all that, right? Or to actually share your feelings in public. We're not even supposed to admit we're having problems in this culture, right? We're supposed to present ourselves as everything is peachy keen all the time.
Yeah, totally agree. And then also even the added financial barrier, you know, it's way cheaper to get a beer than pay like $500 to see a therapist. So, yeah.
That kept me from therapy about 15 years ago. I really needed it. And I tried and I didn't like the first two people I spoke to. And it was a little more money than I wanted to spend to sit down and feel like this person didn't understand me.
Yeah, I feel like therapy is similar to dating. You can't just assume that all therapists are right for you. It has to be the right fit for sure.
Yeah, yeah. My briefly funny story is that I'm a member of Kaiser, with very local thing, but I went to their department and someone interviewed me to assign a therapist. And that person, I was like, wow, you get everything I'm saying. They referred me to someone who would become my therapist, and I didn't feel that feeling at all. I'm like, can I go back to that first person?
Yeah.
I tried to, and then I just gave up. I'm like, wow, even with the copay, this copay is more, you know, so I was about to joke that I just turned to substances, but I actually didn't. I got over it. But anyway, so after you finished at UCLA and you did that summer program, did you just sit down and devote yourself to screenwriting? When did you get the urge to direct?
Yeah, I think that was like my internship era of my life. I interned at like Warner Discovery and the Academy Museum, which if you haven't been, I can hook you up with free tickets if you ever want to go. I interned at Film Independent, Film Nation, and I also got my first non-internship position. I was like a seasonal coordinator at Sundance for their episodic lab. So yeah, all those names, my parents were like, okay, Jeremy has a shot because he's like getting all these professional opportunities. And then, yeah, just on the side, also just writing my own stuff, really more as a hobby. But
I mean, you call writing a hobby, but it's your goal.
Yeah.
But because you're a young college graduate, you still felt like I actually need to advance and get internships. And was that also to learn more, or was it really just, I mean, is there a reason that you call the writing a hobby and that stuff the career?
Yeah. Well, that was kind of like, I didn't expect to be paid as a writer anytime soon, but I knew that I was very good at least pretending to be able to communicate well. And a lot of those internships that I did were related to development. So I was able to read a lot of scripts and see what works and doesn't work. And that helped form my voice as a writer. I would say right now, writing is no longer a hobby. It's something I'm like actively pursuing. But at that time, I was being realistic of like, I don't have any reps. I am still finding my voice, and everything I've written so far, I'll look back in a year and cringe. I think that's like my goal, is to write something where a couple of years later, if I look at it, I won't cringe. That's when I know that I'm doing something well.
I hear you. I mean, needless to say, the reason there's so many director's cuts is, that cringe feature, a lot of, it's hard not to look back on things we do and cringe.
Mm. I know. I think like one of the Indiana Jones movies, Spielberg couldn't even like watch it in the theaters because he was looking at every frame and like being like, oh, I should have done this. Oh, I should have done this. So it's, I think maybe an obsessive thing that filmmakers have of like, nothing I ever create will be perfect.
Well, and certainly, I mean, film of all the arts, film is the most collaborative, which is wonderful, but that means it also has the most amount of compromise. I mean, if you're a painter on a canvas in a studio in your garage, it's just you and the canvas. If you cringe based on what you did, it's all you. But film is so, I mean, even to make the smallest short film, unless you're acting every part and writing, there's just, it's a huge collaboration. And anytime you deal with other human beings, if you think you're in control, you're a fool.
I'll start using that. I like that.
Feel free. So when were you writing stuff all the time? Were you writing features and shorts? Were you picking and choosing, or whatever came to you?
Yeah, I was mostly writing shorts and pilots. I hadn't gotten into features until recently, but one of the shorts I wrote was based on when I had my first ever panic attack. It was something that happened during the pandemic, and I had this like existential dread of like, how can I be a mental health advocate when I'm like dealing with my own mental health issues? I don't know. I didn't realize like that's okay. But when I had my first panic attack, that's when I finally decided to like get a therapist. And being in college, the insurance was pretty nice in that the copay was very little. It no longer is very little. So I haven't had a therapist ever since I graduated. But something that my therapist talked about was like exposure therapy, things that make you anxious. You should like do your best not to run away from them, because then it sets a precedent in your mind to always run away from them. But you need to be exposed to those events. And if you have a positive experience, then you could fall back on them being like, oh, when this happened, it was okay. So if this happens, it will most likely be okay too. One of those exposure therapy instances was the short film. So I wrote the short film that explored my first panic attack. Obviously fictionalized, created a new character and stuff like that. And I also went to one of those like UCLA alumni network events, and someone that I talked to, he was like asking what I've been up to. I told him about the short, and he has a lot of experience producing shorts. So he was like, oh, let's make this. This would be super cheap to make. So I initially thought I was just going to write it, but he really pushed me to direct it as well, because it's based off my lived experience. And then the person I cast to play the son was Patrick, who ended up being the actor in Fish as well. So that was like the connection, because we had a really great experience working with each other on that first project.
Right. So you cast Patrick in an earlier short.
Yeah.
And then, spoiler alert, you and he co-wrote Fish.
Yeah. So the context of that.
But actually, I'm going to interrupt because I brought up Fish.
Go.
So by the way, I mean, so we probably could talk for hours, because I mean, I was aware that you were at UCLA during COVID.
Yeah.
But, But yeah, I mean, it certainly sounds like, I mean, panic attacks during COVID lockdown had to have been incredibly common.
Yeah.
I mean, mental health, our entire society was dealing with something that we had pretty much not dealt with for a couple hundred years. I mean, I guess there was the mislabeled Spanish flu had been 100 years earlier, but you know, no one had any memories.
Yeah, definitely nothing like that in my lifetime. It was very formative for me. I mean, obviously, like, it's such a terrible thing. So many people died from it, and we're still seeing the lasting impacts of that today with like long COVID and stuff like that. I do think COVID helped me learn my priorities in life, though, as I'm sure it did for a lot of people, of like a wake-up call that tomorrow isn't promised, you know, and spending all that time by yourself really helps you decide what you want in life.
Absolutely. And all that isolation really, if people didn't realize it, it reminded us just how badly we need other humans.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, isolation was so unhealthy.
Yeah, it's like wired in our brains that when we eat food and when we see friends, it has the same effect on our brains, you know, and we know how important it is to like eat food. I would argue it's equally as important to like interact with other people.
Right, right. You're saying it's an essential practically, yeah. It's on the level of a biological need.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, so now we can pull Patrick in. And were you happy with that first? So that film, that short about the panic attack, I apologize for just referring to it that way. But
No, that's how I referred to it. Yeah.
All right, cool. How'd you feel about directing?
That was a huge beast. And I think it was a great example of exposure therapy, where it's like, now I'll go to like a social mixer and be like, oh, I'm dreading this. What if this happens? And then I'm like, oh, but you directed this short film literally about your own panic attack, and it turned out well. So like, this is nothing compared to it. So it was a great like precedent setter to help me navigate life now, I guess. Yeah.
Excellent. And you said it came out well.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely feels like it was made by college students, you know, like it's not Oscar worthy by any means, but it's a good, I don't know, it's a good thing to look back on of like who I was at that time and how I've grown since then.
True, that's an excellent point, but I won't drive into it, but certainly people going back and wanting to change their earlier work, that's who you were at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a moment in time. And it helped me, like I learned a lot from that experience that I did end up using on Fish. So it's always like the next steps, whatever you're working on now informs what you do after.
Right. So did Fish come fairly soon after that?
It was like, I would say 2 years after.
So 2 years after. And you stayed in touch with Patrick, I guess?
Well, Patrick basically texted me, like, let's make another short film. And he had basically, I was like, okay, I'm down if we get the right story, because I don't want to just make a short film to do it, because I guess a lot of directors just want that experience, you know, like to be on set. I'm almost the opposite, where it's like, I'll only direct if everything aligns and stuff. So we were ideating script ideas, and then at that time, Everything Everywhere All at Once came out and was super formative for both of us. Just the idea of like using a very highbrow concept, leaning into all these different genres, but at the end, the core is like family relationships. So we really use that as our North Star to write Fish. I would say Fish is more like Patrick's vision story-wise, but he primarily comes from an acting background. So I helped with structure and stuff like that. But
right. So in a way, he pitched the idea to you and you said, this idea is good. Let's write it together.
Yeah, basically. And we went through like several iterations of like what animal we wanted to use. Initially, we wanted to use a dog or a cat, but decided it would be hard to direct them. Whereas a fish, it's a lot more contained. So yeah, that's how we ended up with using a fish, basically.
Right. And that's how you got, so you didn't even have the title yet. The title actually came from, by the way, it's a very wise decision to not deal with dogs and cats because the fish is a great concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even though it wasn't our first choice, in retrospect, it was likely the best choice.
Yeah. Well, and you both obviously, you do some creative things with the fact that it's a fish.
Yeah,
I mean, you can't stick a cat in your mouth.
Yeah. Wait, there's a scene that I really wanted to do, but we didn't have time and budget. But like, I wanted him to get the goldfish out of the bowl and then threaten to flush her down the toilet. But we didn't have enough time. So.
Yeah, I believe he says it to her.
Yeah, so it would have been like show, don't tell, but...
Right, right.
Yeah.
All right, so you write it together and you reach a point where you're like, this is good, let's make it.
Yeah, and again, I was like... when we were writing it, I was very open to the idea of someone else directing it, or even Patrick directing it, but... He wanted me to direct it. So, yeah, because I would say like directing does take a lot out of me. Like writing, I'm like in the zone and there's like basically no cons. But directing is like a very big commitment. But I thought the project was right. And yeah, I ended up directing it. And I'm happy with how it turned out, for sure.
For sure. And I guess, I mean, he knew you. I mean, you directed him before.
Yeah.
So was that his main inspiration for saying you should really direct it? Is he knew you'd do it well?
Yeah. Maybe not knew we'd do it well, but just knew we'd work well together. And then hopefully it turns out well.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And then, well... Sounds like you had a lot of the pieces together already to make a short. Was it a fairly quick process, or?
I literally asked like all the favors because we were broke. So our budget was quite low. At that time, I was actually part of Academy Gold, which is like a diversity initiative that the Academy did to foster creatives from underrepresented communities and give them like access to the industry. And basically half of the crew are people from Academy Gold, like the editor, the composer, some of the gaffers, the first AC. I'm sure I'm missing some, but I was basically just recruiting basically my friends from that program to help me with this project.
Excellent. Excellent. And a fairly quick shoot.
Yeah, we shot it in either 2 or 3 days. I forgot. But it was actually when we were shooting at the restaurant, we could only shoot when they were closed. So we shot at the restaurant from like 10 p.m. to 8 a.m. two nights in a row. And I don't drink coffee at all or caffeine. So that was a interesting experience for me directing in those hours.
I can imagine. But there's, you know, it's hard to fall asleep when you're directing.
Yeah. You fall asleep immediately after. You hibernate for a couple of days after the shoot ends.
For sure. And it sounds like it was all a good experience.
Yeah, I think if you've ever seen Inside Out, the idea of like core memories, that'll definitely be a core memory for the rest of my life.
And it sounded like you were take it or leave it with directing after the first short. But yeah. Now you've directed two.
Mm-hmm.
What's your policy? What's your attitude? Do you still, if you wrote, I mean, whether it's a short or obviously directing a feature is a whole different beast.
Yeah.
But are you interested in directing more shorts or?
It's interesting you say that. So after Fish, I was like, okay, I am most likely not going to direct anymore unless the perfect opportunity comes up. And then a couple months later, I got an offer from like PBS to direct a short documentary. So,
I mean, that couldn't have happened out of the blue. You must have been submitting yourself or part of a program or?
Well, in addition to all the internships I've done, I've also gone through a couple like entertainment labs. And one of the entertainment labs I went through was the Respectability Entertainment Lab. And then one of the people who was also an alumni of that lab knew about my work because of the lab. And they were searching for a director who has like a sci-fi inclination to direct this short documentary that they were doing in partnership with PBS. So yeah, she reached out to me and I was like, this is definitely a scam. but I was like, okay, I'll hop on the Zoom. And then I guess I'll use my gut to see if this is a scam or not. And then I also did like the digital sleuthing to see like, is this person a real person and stuff like that. But yeah, it ended up being real. So I'm currently directing a sci-fi short documentary. A couple weeks ago, I was like in Seattle filming at a science convention for the documentary. And this coming week, I'll be flying to Georgia to do another interview for the doc. So it's funny, like all three of my directing experiences, it wasn't like something I was seeking, but it just ended up happening. Which I don't know. I feel like it's the opposite of what directors usually are trying to do, because directors are like seeking opportunities. I'm just like chilling like a potato and then it just falls on my lap.
They keep coming at you. And it, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned sci-fi because I think Fish in a way I've mentioned words like drama. I mean, I know you submitted it as drama to Film Invasion LA, but also, you know, it definitely has a fantasy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I would consider it sci-fi, but
yeah.
But you have a sci-fi. What's your sci-fi? Have you written sci-fi or are you just a sci-fi fan? The person hiring a director, what made them think of you as a sci-fi person?
So basically all of my pilots and features are sci-fi. I would say Magical realism, which is what Fish is more like, is way cheaper. Sci-fi is like super expensive. So magical realism is like the budget version of sci-fi. But also, if you were to Google my name, like every bio I have, I'm like, I'm a sci-fi writer. I'm a sci-fi writer. I'm a sci-fi writer. So they definitely read my bio and was like, oh, this guy likes sci-fi because he says it in everything, everywhere. So yeah, I feel like sci-fi, kind of like what I talked about earlier, it's like a way for me to cut through the noise by giving an interesting take on a story. And I feel like sci-fi, sometimes people think it's like, oh, it's this futuristic concept, but I use sci-fi to comment on the present day. And usually my sci-fi is like near-fi, like it's like what society could be in 10 or 20 years, stuff like that.
I mean, you are barking up all my favorite trees. I'm a big sci-fi fan, and a lot of my reading is sci-fi. But I mean, I think the number one purpose of sci-fi is it allows storytellers to talk about what's going on now, but in a context where people can absorb it without feeling lectured, right? Like,
yeah, exactly.
Like, so sci-fi is best done that way.
Yeah.
And I feel like funny you mentioned near-fi too, because I've recently been reading a lot of cli-fi, which is climate change sci-fi that's near-fi. So it's like, what's happening with climate change and then 20, 30 years from now, and we're having our first mass deaths and things from heat. But anyway, I interrupted you just to share that I like this stuff.
No, I mean, I agree. I think climate change is sci-fi is a great way to comment on climate change for sure. At the same time, I also think like story always comes first. Because if you ever feel didactic, then the viewer gets bored, or even like not even bored, but like angry. So I view like the message almost like as the cherry on top, but the story needs to be the base for sure.
For sure. Yeah. And you absolutely, you nailed another nail, which is sci-fi can be the most expensive genre.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you just have to, if you're writing creatively, you might be world building.
Yeah.
And if you are building a world that doesn't exist, that logistically, that dollar sign, dollar, the budget grows immensely when you have to set it in another place and time.
Yeah. I would say original sci-fi is almost never greenlit. It's always based on like IP, like books of famous authors, like we saw with Dune, you know. And I'm very aware of that. But I don't know. Sci-fi is just something I love writing.
Yeah, you know, stuff sneaks in.
Yeah.
And then it always does well because it's original and great. But I won't mention recent sci-fi I've loved in the last 5 years, because heck, the next podcast you're going to talk about favorite films. I don't want to bias anything.
Yeah.
Well, so, and are you writing all the time now? Oh, so you were working on the documentary, and it sounds like it's not a full-time situation. So you still have time for writing and whatnot?
Yeah. It's just a part-time gig. And I've also just been, I spend most of my days writing. I'm currently developing a sci-fi feature with Wondermind. Wondermind is like a mental health focused production company. And yeah, outside of that, just ideating on like other script ideas in that sci-fi realm.
Excellent. Excellent. I love it. I'm looking for now. No pressure, but I'm really looking forward to seeing seeing more work from you, especially in the sci-fi world, because it is, it's just, you know, one of my favorites. I also really do love magical realism, obviously.
Mm. Yeah, me too. Magical realism is the much cheaper sci-fi, I think. Yeah.
And it's funny, I was never considered myself a, you know, like a fantasy person.
Mm.
But actually, I've learned that the line between fantasy and sci-fi is blurred too.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of overlap. I mean, the distinction I think of is sci-fi is based on science, and then fantasy is based on magic. That's basically the difference. Otherwise, it's the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. And some of my favorite authors really blur it. Like, yeah. I'm a big N.K. Jemisin fan.
Name does not ring a bell.
No worries. But yeah, her writing is okay. It's amazing. And it's mostly sci-fi, but then, yeah, magic creeps in here and there.
Mm.
But hey, she's building completely original worlds, so she can do whatever she wants.
Yeah. Maybe it's a science fantasy is that genre. It's that
I guess so. I guess so, yeah. No reason to have these hard labels, but...
Yeah.
And anything else going on before we move on and wrap this one up and then do the four questions one?
No, I think that's everything. Thank you for like creating this space for filmmakers like me to talk about themselves. And yeah, I had such a great experience at your film festival. You're definitely one of the best, if not the best, film festival experience I had. So grateful for all that you do for the indie film community.
Ah, thank you. Thank you. I'm, you know, every year it's the same thing for me. Like, oh my God, I hope there's great films. No control over it. But yeah, that's why I might come across as a bit effusive in the praise and things, but I always joke with people, that's because you didn't see the 600-700 films that aren't in the festival. You know, for now, I still watch them all. Actually, this Film Invasion 2024 might be the first time I don't watch everything.
Mm.
I've managed to emotionally let go of feature documentary. Mm. The rest of the jury can pick that. I don't have the time anymore. But yeah, when you watch 500-600 films, the best 50, you just love them. You know, it's great. And we can't have a good festival without good film. All right. Well, I think we're good. Do you want to, by the way, so much interesting work you're doing. Is there a social media or a website or something that people should follow for you?
Yeah, I guess my Instagram, which is just my name, Jeremy HSING.
Yeah, Jeremy. And that'll be a clickable link on the show notes of the podcast. That our good friend Calvin will do. And all right, I'll wrap us up so that we can also get to your four questions in the next episode. So thank you everyone for listening to the Discovery Indie Film Podcast. Jeremy just shared his story and I thought it was a great one, and looking forward, everyone should watch his film. So where do I start? All right, first, this is the Discovery Indie Film Podcast. If you'd like to learn more about it, just go to discoverindiefilm.com. On social media, it's always at DIFWINS. This podcast did give birth to a Amazon Prime series. So if you go to Amazon Prime Video and you type in Discover Indie Film, somewhere along the way it auto-completes, and there are currently 7 seasons that are wonderful short films handpicked from the festival circuit for people to enjoy. And fingers crossed, there'll be another season of that, with fish included. But if you don't have the patience, you can catch fish on TV High. Just go to watchtvhigh.com for that. And Jeremy was kind to say that he had a great experience at Film Invasion Los Angeles. We hold that festival every June, and we are talking in the middle of April. So June is coming way too fast for me. I need the world to slow down so that I have enough time for everything we've got to do between now and then. But If you want to learn more about Film Invasion Los Angeles, just go to filminvasionla.com, and it's at Film Invasion LA on social media. It has a sister festival that we hold the week after Thanksgiving. So this year, that's in December. So if you want to learn about the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, just go to shermanoaksff.com, and it's at shermanoaksff on social media. Honestly, the two festivals, same venue, same team. The only difference is the name and the logo. And for some reason, Sherman Oaks has outgrown Film Invasion. Now Sherman Oaks keeps growing bigger and bigger. I guess people prefer that name, but Film Invasion LA still does well. And I'm just bragging now because Sherman Oaks this December is going to be two screens at once, two theaters. We've outgrown a single theater. Film Invasion LA will still be one theater for now. But I'm stressing about the two theaters at once thing, I'll tell you that. But anyway, I think I've said all I need to say. Jeremy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and thank you everyone for listening.